Well, good day and welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the program this week. We've got a special second half episode coming up for you again this week, where we pick up with our episode from last week talking about dealing with work-related stress and burnout and dealing with how you manage that, both in yourself and your coworkers. And we'll be talking about that, continuing this discussion as we pick up with Sam Bradley's comments in response to how Jim Brasil ended it last week. Again, our guest this week, myself, co-host Sam Bradley. We have Joe Holly from Paragon Medical Education Group and Dr. Jim Brasil, who is an educator and consultant for EMS and emergency medicine. And he is working on helping people transition from situations where they are dealing with work-related stress in non-positive ways and helping them to find better outlets for their challenges with stress and burnout. So let's go ahead and pick up with part two of this episode on stress and burnout. It's a difficult topic, but I think we talk a little bit about some of the solutions that might be available for people out there, and you should check it out. Here it is.
Well, you know, that actually brings up an interesting question, and maybe Joe and Jamie can reflect on this, but you think of burnout as when it's passion fatigue. You've lost your compassion for people. But the point you made, and I didn't even see that, was here's somebody who still seems to really care because it pains them to interact with all of these people and seeing the bad things that are happening to them. So that's kind of a whole different dynamic. I don't know. What do you think about that, Jamie?
Well, I think they've lost sight of the good that we can do in those situations, and that's a shame. And that's I think what comes back to my point of finding that passion, finding the reason why we do it. We see people in some pretty awful circumstances, and we also see people. You know, when I see those people, I see the light in their eyes that, oh, thank God, someone's here to help.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like this individual looks in those eyes and he sees the death and the sorrow and the fear and not the hopefulness that this person can change things for them. And I think that's the difference. And maybe Jim could touch on this, it just seems to me like that's where we need to help people find that again.
God, good point. You know, or you got to wonder, is this guy's day just full of these really downer calls? Does he never deliver a baby or,
well, they
you
can
know,
all
see
be,
a child
You know, they
smile?
Can all be downer calls. I mean, you could argue that we see people in situations that aren't optimal. That, you know, people, I know people in my area that don't like to go to the nursing home because it's people at the end of their life. Whereas I look at going to the nursing home as a wonderful opportunity to meet some amazing people and hear some wonderful stories about what the world has changed, how the world has changed. And there's two mm-hmm. different perspectives to approaching essentially the same patient.
I want to throw this at Joe, but I got to throw something out in here because you just reminded me. My cousin's a physician in Denver, and she's a hospice doc, and she deals with elderly and a lot of people that are dying. And I in my mind, I'm going, how does she manage that? But she has a perspective on how death can be. It's inevitable, but it can be a beautiful thing. And she writes to me about, oh, Agnes passed away today, and it was beautiful because of this and this and this. So I think the point you're making is it's really all a matter of perspective sometimes. What do you think about that, Joe?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I expect she gets great satisfaction out of making that very difficult process more comfortable and safe and the right thing for the patient.
And helping them transition, basically.
Exactly right. And I think that's a lot of places where I think that's one of the leading causes of sort of burnout is just that we no longer get any satisfaction because we don't feel like we're doing any good for the patient. And I think that it's challenging to maintain your perspective on that. And you know, I think part of the solution there is when you're beginning to feel like I'm doing the same thing for this patient and it's going nowhere, maybe it's because what you're doing for that patient isn't what that patient needs. And you got to look a little deeper, and you got to figure out some other something that may be necessary to do to actually, you know, get that patient what they need, and for you to regain your satisfaction in actually doing what we all came into this profession to do, which is to take care of people.
Yeah, and she takes joy in patients that most of us don't want to deal with, because it's just the way she happens to look at it, and helping them leave this world and knowing that, you know, we think about bringing people into the world as being a joyful thing. We don't often think about sending them out, and that's the way she's able to look at it. And I don't know, maybe being a cancer survivor herself is part of that perspective, but it's a really interesting dynamic.
Well, and I want to bring up a point here, Sam, because I don't want people to think that, you know, my life is all kittens and rainbows. I mean...
It's not. I got the kittens. I thought you had the room.
It's I've had my share of calls that have really impacted me negatively, and I've had to seek help, and find somebody to talk to, and seek out that mentor both professionally and medically to deal with some situations that have occurred. But I think that's. But I was also in a system or a place, either personally or in the system I was in, that supported me doing that, and I think that's as much a sign of the culture of the workplace. And I know, Jim, you've said you've run some companies, and would you agree that it really comes down to culture and how much support and backup that these people get?
Yeah, absolutely, and I have to say that. One of my mentors in medicine was the dean of my medical school. His wife was an end-of-life physician. And he is one of my biggest mentors in medicine. And both of them taught me how to deal with that. And I had the opportunity to kind of work with them and take the walk with several patients. And that prepared me to deal with an incident that Sam and I had with the fire department we teach. And I had the opportunity to actually take the walk with one of our firemen toward the end and
at
help
end.
Him transition. So, you know,
dead, yeah.
it's a sad thing that happens, but you have to understand that that's part of medicine, that's part of life, and that's part of how it works. There's a beginning and there's an ending.
And it's interesting because
a real hard problem latching into the fact that there is an ending, because we're trained that you don't die in an ambulance ever.
True.
And that's a very hard thing to tell a paramedic, that yeah, it's okay to have an ending. They're okay with doing it in somebody's home, but if they do it a lot and have a lot of negative outcomes that are, you know, not their fault, it's the way it goes, that starts to weigh on them. And you can hear it in this person's voice. I've held the dead baby, I've held the dead grandma. How does the company deal with that? How does the employer say, all right, so if you have a code, then you automatically get a day off with pay? I mean, I don't know that they can do that. I don't know that that's practical. But I think that when they notice a lot of code paperwork coming across the desk from the same people,
yeah,
maybe they need to start saying, hey, how you doing? Why don't you and I go out to have coffee and we'll talk a little bit?
Good point.
Start to, like, proactively provide the debriefing. And if you see things in that person, then you need to send them to the next level. It's not a mandatory interview with a psychologist. It's an opportunity to just talk. I had a very close friend. We're still very close friends. And he has been in EMS for quite some time. We my partner and I really wanted to be his preceptor, but it didn't work out that way. We had a call with him where he had like six patients already packaged by the time we got there. It was quite impressive. This guy's been a paramedic now for, I think, close to 20 years. And he went in after having a bad call, sat down with a psychologist and started talking, and kind of went into the zone and was just telling the story about all these things, and all these different calls started coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we work in an area that's, or I worked, and they still work in an area that's not quite rainbows and kittens. I like that one. He kind of came to realization while he was talking to her that she was responding a little bit negatively, and he looked up and she was sobbing with a box of Kleenex in her lap, and he actually broke a psychologist.
Oh, that's right.
So you really need to pick the person you talk to. If you're going to go talk to a psychologist, you might want to ask them, have you been dealing with people in medicine? Have you ever counseled a paramedic before?
May not be ready for this.
Yeah, there are people that really are not ready to hear, yeah, you know what? I held a dead baby.
Or yeah, that right there.
The car was over, the baby flew out of the car seat, and we found it under the tire. They're not ready to hear that.
Well, and I have to mention, too, the experience that you and I had with the firefighter, and he made it very clear. You know how firefighters are, as are many EMS people. They're very tight. They take care of their own. This man was dying of cancer, and he was never left alone at the end for weeks on end. And I went in to do my shift with him, and there were a lot of people there. And he'd said, whatever happens, I don't want to die alone. And he died that night with 10 of us, had our hands on him. And as much as this was kind of strange, it's one of those things that, Joe, you can relate to from the Pentagon and Ground Zero, where it's a strangely ugly, awesome, but profound experience. I don't know. It's hard to put into words. Maybe you could do better than I am, but it's something that I'm glad I did because it gave me a whole different perspective. And now I can kind of understand where my cousin comes from, because that was a beautiful experience. The situation that killed him was not, but our ability to see him out was. What do you think, Joe? I don't know.
Well, I'd agree with you, Sam. I think the issue there, certainly after a major event, you know, a major disaster event especially, where the scale and scope of things is much larger than what we're used to dealing with, it's very easy for people to get lost in that. I think it can be a profoundly positive experience, but I think it's also really important to monitor and guide and assist people through that experience because it can be very overwhelming. We certainly had one guy that went to the Pentagon with us at 9/11 that had some chronic disease problems and came back from that very stressed out, and that resulted in some, you know, exacerbations of his chronic inflammatory disease processes that he had. And he got very, very sick and ultimately died a few months after, you know, returning
wow.
from the Pentagon. Whether or not that was directly related or not, obviously I don't know, but you know, certainly it's known that stress plays into all that sort of stuff. And I think it, having a way to assess your people, look at your folks, talk with your people, and that debriefing process, for lack of a better term, has great value in it, just to let folks know that they're not by themselves, that they're all sharing this experience, and trying to find the good in that experience is really what I think a lot of what makes the difference.
Well, Joe, since you mentioned that, let me throw this kind of back at you medically, but because you're talking about a guy that had some real problems, and I know several on my team that now have respiratory issues they didn't have before we went to Ground Zero. But you have a situation where, hold on just a second. When you're stressed, your immune system takes a hit. And when you're one of the things I learned in all the training I did was when you're trying not to deal with something, you're actually expending more energy than if you were to deal with it. So you get these people that are stressed, their immune systems take a dump, any chronic issues that they have probably are going to exacerbate. And then there's just a spiral. If you don't correct it, it can end up this way. How, you know, what do you think about this medically? Is that true?
Well, I certainly think there's some impact from chronic stress and, you know, many inflammatory conditions from things like, you know, psoriatic arthritis to Crohn's disease to, you know, allergic respiratory problems all have a significant immunological component to them. And as you mentioned, when you're under great levels of stress, you're producing lots of stress hormones, and that's affecting your how your body's immune system responds. So, you know, I think those things do have an impact on people. I don't know that we can quantify how much that is, and I think it varies from person to person. But I think there's no question there's an impact from those stressful situations on folks.
Well, it begs the question, how many apparent medical issues might actually be related to stress? Jamie, why don't you throw in on that one?
I don't know. I've always had a belief that stress has some issues. I mean, I have a daughter with rheumatoid arthritis. I see how, you know, she always has a flare up. You know, she's in college and she always has a flare right after finals are done. You know, and she knows it. She calls a rheumatologist and she does what she can to prepare, and she makes sure she's taking her meds, and she tries to do some things to alleviate stress. But at the end of finals week, she when she comes home, she's laid up for a day or two with one of her joints bothering her to the point that she can barely move. And it's just, so I see that. It may be anecdotal, but I always have believed stress has a bigger effect. We certainly see it in critical incident stress, how it affects the outward appearance of people and how they deal with people emotionally. And if they're not sleeping well, that's affecting their outcomes. They're fatigued. They're not tracking well. They're not making good decisions. There's all these things that come from the stress.
Good point. And we were talking about resources and things we can do, but you have a medic that goes home to a wife who is not in the business, and you're going, oh, wow, I had this really bad call today. It was this traffic accident. She's going, ew, I don't want to hear about that. So you can't really diffuse yourself with her. Maybe many of your friends aren't in the business. I don't know. Not everybody has the ability to have somebody they can talk to, maybe off duty, that really understands what they're talking about. And maybe their company doesn't provide resources. What else is there, Jim?
You know, that's hard to say. What else is there? There are people that feel like there's nothing. I recently lost a very close friend because I'm quite sure he felt like there was nothing else he could do.
Yes, you did.
Kills me to this day. He, without a doubt, was the best paramedic I ever knew.
Yes, he was. And that just shows you what happens when people give up. And I guess the bottom line here is we got to figure out a way to get to people before they get to that point of no return. And like I said, even looking at this first little vignette that I talked about, we can't let people get that far. And it's hard. It's just, maybe it's because I was invested in CISM for that large company for so many years, that how can you not notice this in other people? And you guys are saying, yeah, you can.
Well, and I think it comes down to education, Sam. I really do.
Yeah.
I think we need to, you know, I think critical incident stress and and dealing with stress in the job and the workplace and what we do needs to be more than a few paragraphs in a textbook when somebody's studying. And it needs to be more than just an offhand mention, that it needs to be part of our required education. You know, if we're going to be paramedics and we're going to do our continuing education, perhaps a portion of our continuing education should be required to be stress management techniques. And it could be yoga, it could be, you know, it could be whatever the workplace wants to put into place as the training for that particular segment of the class. But it can be something about dealing with stress and doing it constructively and recognizing it in your coworkers and what to do when you recognize it in your coworkers, how to approach them, how to find resources for them. These are things that can be done. We require us to take ACLS every 2 years, and we take PALS or PEP or some other pediatric class every 2 years, and all the other things that we have to do for our 60 hours or plus of paramedic recertification every 2 years. Why don't we make an hour of that or 2 hours of that dealing with stress in the workplace?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I don't know. You're right. I think education is the way to go. So Joe, how do you incorporate this into all the classes that you do? Because just about everything you guys teach at Barragan has these elements of really bad things that happen to people. How do you do that?
Well, I think we do indirectly. I mean, I think a lot of that is about sort of stress inoculation and a realization that even though you're in a disaster or a mass casualty situation, you can put aside you can control and direct the stress to a productive and positive outcome under the circumstances, which in the big picture gives you back that sense of satisfaction, as opposed to I froze up and I was so scared I couldn't do anything, and all I did was, hide and wait for things to get better. A sense that I was actually able to overcome that and take care of some patients and provide some care to somebody, which gives you back that sense of personal satisfaction and the reason that you're in the job in the first place. And I think that positive satisfaction is part of what gives you the ability to deal with the stress. I expect that letter you read from that guy earlier, if he'd had a few more interventions with patients where he felt like he really did some good and really made a difference in somebody's life, he wouldn't be quite so gloomy in his perspective of what he does. I mean, that was obviously very negative, and clearly that guy's desperately in need of some positive, feedback, if anything else, just to help him realize that what he's doing is actually being beneficial to somebody and doing some good in the world. Everybody just wants to make a contribution and appreciate the fact that what they're doing is good for people and good for society and good for them.
I want to go give him a kitten.
That's another place where the employer needs to step in and say,
absolutely.
Good job today.
Exactly. And that's kind of what I was alluding to earlier. Even if a company can't afford to pay their people a whole bunch of money, acknowledging their efforts, giving kudos to, something we do in Alameda County every year is have a big award ceremony, and we bring survivors together with the firefighters and the EMS people. And it's a way of acknowledging the good stuff. The calls that didn't look like somebody were going to survive. And that kind of thing, I think, really does make a difference. Do you have something like that you do in nursing, Jamie?
No, I don't think quite as organized as all of that. But there are some facilities and some workplaces out there that do a really good job of giving people an attaboy for doing a good job and for doing a difficult job well. And those are the hospitals, and Joe and Jim can probably attest to this in their communities and in their experience. Those are the hospitals where everybody wants to work, surprisingly enough. it is the places that value their employees and value their workforce that keep their employees. And that's no different in EMS or in nursing or in physician practices. They are going to keep the people that feel valued.
Really good point. I think that's the key point. You know, showing people they're respected and showing people that they're valued. I mean, we're all going to have bad calls. That's just the nature of the beast. But it's just like people dying. I mean, that, you know, I was thinking about that earlier, that it's a fact of life that people are going to die. And to be upset about every old person who dies doesn't really make a lot of sense. That's just, you know, you were wording it in terms of not being comfortable with the guy that didn't want to go to the con home because he couldn't handle the fact that the people were at the end of their life. So I guess when we juxtapose that against my cousin, there's just two very different perspectives of how you look at the same thing.
And it is perspective. And I think that we need to work on that educational process to look within ourselves and improve our outlook on our job on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, some days we're going to go in not feeling as happy and wanting to go to work as others. That's part of having a job, I think. But we need to recognize those times when we don't have the goal to go to work on a repeated basis with a positive attitude, that is the time when we need to reevaluate our perspective and reevaluate where we're coming from, and do we need some assistance? Do we need somebody to put us back on track? And that may be a workplace counselor. It may be a management person, a mentor, a pastoral counselor, or somebody in a spiritual role. It can be different people for different individuals, but we need to be able to educate ourselves to recognize that in ourselves and in others so that we can help guide ourselves and other people to the resources that they need.
And don't be afraid to ask for it. And I think that's part of the problem. We get back to the way it used to be before CISM was accepted. You know, let's belly up to the bar, boys, and if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. So we have to recognize within ourselves, like you were saying, when you get up too many times and you don't want to go to work, you need to think about that and do something about it.
Well, yeah, we, on a regular basis, the night shift in Oakland, we'd go out and drink.
Not during the shift. You better qualify that.
There you go.
Well, yeah, at the end of the shift, when we got off
thank
and came back, we would meet at a bar.
And that's
on a regular basis, the same thing down in another community I worked in with the same old partner. We'd get off shift, and we worked 24s in this place, and we would go and meet at a central location and go to the bar. I mean, it was just the way we did it.
And I don't even want to think about the fact you all drove home drunk.
Well, drunk.
Well.
Responsibly.
Well, okay. We'll leave that one alone.
At the same time, yeah, there was probably a little bit of that too. And, you know, you're driving home in a uniform in a car and you're weaving all over the place. All you do is tell the officer you're sleepy.
And DUIs can be career ending.
Yes, they can. Especially here in California when they take ambulance driver's license away.
Yes, they do. And I think Jamie's about ready to throw us off the air here. We could keep this going for a long time, and I really hope we come back and revisit this and maybe look at, maybe focus a little bit more on more positive. We kind of touched on a few things, but I'd really like to look at some of the other things we can do and encourage people to get help and look at this from a little more positive perspective in terms of what we can do about it.
Well, and I think one of the things we can do is that we can, you know, link to some positive resources. I'll make sure I include the link to that book by Elizabeth Scala, and we should also point out that the training and things that people like Jim do, that people like Joe do, the Paragon Medical Education Group is putting people, like he said, inoculating them for stress. by really putting them in a training situation that's as close to as stressful as the real thing as possible, so that they are prepared for the stress that they're going to deal with and the situations that they may encounter. And Joe, you guys talk about that all the time, but I think that's as much part of it as anything else. Train as you would want to work.
Oh, I agree with you, Jamie. It is about learning how to take those situations where you feel like you have no control and finding a way to give people control. And I think that's what reduces the stress level and allows people to feel like they got through that process in a productive way instead of a destructive way.
Keep up the good work, Joe. We need people to do that.
So let me make an editorial here. Since I lost my partner of many, many years to a gun at his own hand, you know, we all identify ourselves. I'm a doctor. I'm a paramedic. I'm a nurse. In the end, it's just the job you do. And if somebody does something that upsets you at that job, talk to somebody. Don't put a gun in your mouth. It isn't worth the job to kill yourself. It's just a job. Talk to someone, and we can get you to the next day, and then the next day after that. It doesn't have to end violently for yourself because something happened in your job.
Well, I think you made a really good point there, Jim, in that it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And,
exactly.
And I think it's hard for folks to appreciate that sometimes.
Because the people you're going to leave behind are going to have to do a broadcast like this to talk about burnout.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's it. You always leave people behind. And when we look at that person who was also a friend of mine and the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that reacted to that he'd known over the years, it was just amazing how many lives he had touched that he probably didn't even realize. So thanks for that very depressing going out message, but it's a good one.
No,
and I hope that
it's
people...
important.
Maybe somebody out there that needs to hear it will hear it, and that's my hope.
So, Jim, where can folks find you, what you're doing, your consulting work and things like that? Where can folks
dig you? You can find me online. I'm at readyenterprises.org. I teach all over the San Francisco Bay Area. I guest lecture at several different places. I do simulation training in Fairfield, California. And so look for me in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that's where you'll find me. I also do Skype tutoring for people that are interested in taking board exams like the USMLE or other very hard tests. I can sit down and tutor you in any number of medical sciences online.
Well, that's a good thing.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely have links to all that in the show notes for you as well, Jim. Thank you. Joe, what about Paragon and you guys? Where can we find you?
Well, you can find Paragon on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com and by the same moniker on Facebook. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Excellent. How about you, Sam?
Well, I'm in the usual social media places, Facebook, Twitter, Sam Bradley 11 in most places, and most certainly and most proudly to be on the disaster.com website. And where do we find the PodMedic?
Well, it's disasterpodcast.com. You can find
me. Did I not say that?
That's all right. It's all good. No, it's all good because I'm going to say it again. Disasterpodcast.com.
Disasterpodcast.com.
Yep, you can find us both there. And, of course, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media circles as well. So look me up and friend me or follow me there. But, again, come back to the Disaster Podcast site. Leave a comment. comment, leave a question for us there on the comments below any of the episode links, and we'd love to hear back from you. That automatically emails us and lets you know when you leave a comment, and we'll get back and leave a comment in return. So if you have something you'd like Jim to contribute to, or Joe, or myself, or Sam, leave a comment on this episode, and we'll get back to you. That's it for me, I think, Sam. You know, we've had a difficult conversation here in this episode, but I think one that was important to have because of the type of situations in medicine we deal with.
I agree, and you can see how passionate we all are about and about people getting help. Like Jim was saying, people not ending their careers or their lives, and there is help out there. And we hope that somebody is touched by this, and we'd love to get some feedback from you, like Jamie said. If this is a topic that you would like to see in some other form or to continue, please do let us know. And I guess, as always, and this, even though we're talking more about our domestic everyday medicine, this is a disaster. This is a disaster within our own medicine. So disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.